We started the invasion with 582 transports. By the time we reached the target, we were down to 461.
Line up! Move it! Move it! Move it!
With the exception of Ray Freeman, who sat in a far corner sorting his gear, every man stood at attention. My platoon moved to the rear of the kettle, ready to charge the moment the doors opened. They held their M27s across their chests. From here on out, we would act like war machines, not men. The heavy metal doors of the kettle started their slow swing apart. When the opening was large enough for two men to run out side by side, I sent my men out.
Move it, move it, move it!
We knew the drill, and we ran it by the numbers. First, we would secure the area. We would not encounter resistance, of course, not on this level of the planet. It was just for landing and taking off. I had my platoon break into squads, and my squads break into fire teams. Only when we were ready for battle did I observe my surroundings. The topography of the civilian sector looked no different than the top layer of the military district. The space was flat and open, with elevator stations spaced miles apart. Hundreds of transports landed around us. 200 feet above me, the gravity chute kept spitting out transports. Every 5 seconds, another one fell from that hole in the sky. But I did not have time to watch.
Platoon 103, move out. Where's he going?
Tomer pointed across an open stretch. I turned and saw Freeman tromping toward an elevator station, his rifle case in one hand.
Just you worry about your own men. If that man does what he came here to do, this battle is going to go a whole lot easier. That guy scares me. He ought to. Double time!
I had my platoon move toward the nearest elevator station. Other platoons followed. My men reached the station first. A four-man fire team lined up with two men on either side of the door. The automatic rifleman, Private Mark Phillips, peered in the door, then gave the all-clear sign. Warning lights were blinking in the elevator room.
I think they know we're here.
I get that feeling.
I hope them Mogi boys weren't planning on using this little elevator station, because I claim this in the name of the Unified Authority.
Stow it, Phillips.
Across the flatness of the man-made plane, tens of thousands of armor-clad Marines captured five elevator stations. By taking different stations, we spread ourselves over a several-mile area. We would need to regroup before the enemy arrived, but we had no choice. The elevator stations were a bottleneck. It could take hours to funnel 48,000 Marines through them, and we had minutes, not hours. I followed my men into the building. Ahead of me, one of my men stared down to the lower levels through the opening in the center of the floor. The virtual dog tag identified him as Evans.
It's like we're invading a specking anthill.
I stared down as well. It was like invading an anthill, except all of the ants had run for cover. The ground below us looked like a bedroom community. I saw buildings that looked like apartment complexes. I saw stores. What I did not see was people.
Welcome to Planet Homo.
Homo?
It's short for Planetary Home of Morgan.
That sounds like something Phillips would say.
We stationed snipers around the railing to fire at anyone they saw on the level below. Then we forced the doors of the elevator open and sent men rappelling down the shafts to the next level. My men were among the first to drop to the next level. We hit the deck below and looked for enemies. We found the area abandoned. The people must have run for cover. This was the civilian district. I saw four-story tenements in every direction. I saw roads and storehouses and medical clinics. As I turned toward the nearest tenement, a blue frame appeared around the building in my visor. A simple message appeared along the bottom of my visor. Capture objective. My men received the same message.
Why the hell should we waste time capturing an apartment building?
Stevens, hand me that rocket launcher.
PFC Stevens, a grenadier, did as asked. He selected a handheld rocket launcher from his gear and gave it to me.
Boys, this is the best built home you will ever see.
There was no debris, and the smoke cleared in seconds, because the rocket did not so much as smudge the tenement.
What the hell?
Shields, Evans. They have shields protecting every building on this planet.
Every building? So how the speck are we supposed to take a building with speck and missile-proof shields?
I don't think we'll have much of a problem. The shields are only on the outside wall. Once you get inside, everything is breakable.
The apartment building had an open doorway, just like the spaceports and elevator stations. The Mogats had never been invaded. They did not expect an invasion.
Evans, secure the first floor. Tomer, you've got the second floor. Greer, take your squad and secure the third. Got it?
Evans's squad ran in first. One of the men tossed the smoke grenade through the doorway. All three of Evans's fire teams stormed into the building under the cover of the smoke.
Evans, run a heat vision sweep. What do you see?
This is a civilian dwelling.
Yeah, that's what you find in civilian sectors.
There are people in the apartments, Master Sergeant.
Flesh them out. We want the building to ourselves. Do you read me?
As we cleared the apartment building, other platoons prepared in other ways. Demolitions teams placed mines on the train wells and traffic ramps. We hid snipers and grenadiers along the roads. We had time to burrow in, but I did not hold much hope. The same shields that protected the building would protect the trains and armored transports. We might derail a train or knock over a transport, but we had no prayer of defending ourselves until the MOGAT shields were down. I entered the tenement lobby. The last remnant of smoke still hung in the air. My men had trampled the lamps and smashed furniture on their way in. As I looked down a hall, I saw a Marine rifleman kick a door open and step back as his automatic rifleman charged in. A woman carrying a baby with three young children came galloping in my direction. I stepped out of their way, and they ran through the lobby and out into the street. Over the next few minutes, dozens of people followed. Men, boys, women, girls, children alone, children with adults. Those shots were a wake-up call. I ran down the hall and stopped by an open door in which one of my men stood pointing his weapon. Inside that apartment, a man lay sprawled on the ground in a kidney bean-shaped puddle of blood.
Report?
The guy had a gun!
Near enough to the corpse to be covered with blood, an old-fashioned automatic pistol lay on the floor.
That was a bad choice on his part. Tomer, Greer, stay alert. Evans already found one MOGAT packing a gun. There may be more in the building.
I looked back at the body, an old man with gray and white hair dressed in an old t-shirt. There might be 200 million more like him on this planet. Why did these assholes ever pick this war? I stood by a window on the third floor, watching a steady flow of Marines pour out of the elevator station. Nearly 20 minutes had passed since we landed on the planet. I wondered how much time we would have before the MOGATs would arrive. We found 200 or 300 people living in the building and turned them out. Some screamed at us. One woman tried to attack one of my Marines with her bare hands. Her husband dragged her back and thanked my Marine for not shooting her. I could not believe it. He actually thanked the man who had just evicted them from their home. The woman was short and chubby with 6 screaming children. Shooting her might have been an act of kindness. I stood in her tiny 2-room apartment now. Judging by the mattresses stacked along the wall, 4 of her children slept in a room that doubled as the family room, living room, and kitchen. On their wall was a family portrait and a picture of Morgan Atkins. They had a bookshelf with storybooks, a small bin of toys, and 8 copies of Man's True Place in the Universe, the Space Bible. The entire apartment was 20 feet wide and maybe 30 feet across, about the size of a doctor's office. And 8 people lived in this hole. From where I stood, I had a clear view of the city around us. Blocks away, the traffic ramps rose out of the ground like attic doors. The MOGAT army would use those ramps if they came to retaliate. Just a half mile away, the magnetically charged lines of several train tracks funneled into a train station. Normally, we would destroy the tracks and traffic ramps, but these had shields. The colonel, the highest-ranking Marine to accompany the invasion, called me over the interlink.
Sergeant Harris, are you and your men comfortable in that cozy little hotel you captured?
Just dandy, sir.
Sergeant, I have it on good authority that the first wave of MOGATs will be here in less than 10 minutes. I would like to offer you and your men front row seats if you're feeling up to it.
Scared we'll miss the action?
I just thought you'd want to be in on it. Your choice. Train station or traffic ramp?
You know, sir, I've always had a thing for trains.
2 other platoons replaced us as we left the building. They would fight from behind the shielded walls we had captured. Leaving the tenement gave me the same feeling I sometimes got when I parachuted out of a transport. I had the uneasy feeling of leaving safety behind. To our right was an elevator station from which a steady stream of Marines continued to pour.
Harris, you and your platoon better hurry if you want to catch a train.
Yes, sir.
The colonel transmitted virtual beacons to guide us to the station. The beacons led us through alleys rather than along main streets. We ran another 3 blocks, crossed an open square that was probably the MOGAT version of a commons. Then we arrived. The train station had a roof, but no walls. Weather was not an issue in this artificial environment. Another platoon had already set up. The lieutenant in charge came out to greet us.
Sergeant Harris, am I ever glad to see you?
What's the situation, sir?
We've mined the tracks. I have snipers on every roof.
Do you know how much longer till they arrive?
How could I know that?
Evans, search the station. There should be a computer monitoring which tracks are in use. I want men with rocket launchers watching each of those tracks.
Got it.
I turned back to the lieutenant.
My men and I will have a look. I'll let you know if we find anything.
I found your control system.
Open band. We need everyone to hear you.
Where's the first train?
Track number 7. It arrives in 38 seconds.
I got this one.
Phillips trotted off toward a track, carrying a rocket launcher in his right hand and his M27 in his left.
I'll watch him.
No, Tomer. I'll go with Phillips. Take care of the rest of your squad.
There are trains coming down tracks 1, 3, 8, 9, and 11.
Did you get that, Lieutenant?
Got it. My men can take 8, 9, and 11.
The tracks were trenches with plasticized edges and metal floors. They were 5 feet deep and 15 feet across, and they seemed to worm their way under the horizon. The trains used magnetic levitation. I ran to join Phillips. At the edge of our vision, the train sped toward us. A mine blew up beneath it, and the train seemed to wriggle in the track. Another mine exploded. The cars kicked from side to side in the track.
Steady, Phillips.
I hope they shut down those shields soon.
Hit the train low. Let's try to upend it.
Damn it, Master Sarge, I know that!
A star-shaped flame exploded beneath the base of the train. Phillips had fired a damn near perfect shot. What happened next was as beautiful as any ballet. The train veered toward the edge of the track as its nose kicked up, barreling forward at hundreds of miles an hour when the rocket struck. The engine bounced nearly 3 feet on its magnetic cushion, enough to leap the edge of the track. The rest of the train followed, twisting over on its side as it did.
Nice shooting, Phillips.
For the first time, maybe in his whole entire life, Phillips had nothing to say. He stood staring at the carcass of the train, absolutely silent. Perhaps he was in awe of what he had accomplished. We heard men firing rockets a few tracks away. One of the Marines from the other platoon fired his rocket too early. It struck the track more than 100 feet ahead of the oncoming train. The train continued to barrel toward us, but mines blew up beneath it, creating small geysers of flame that flashed and disappeared. The Marine fired his second rocket. It struck the engine head-on, but too high. Then a Marine two tracks down fired a rocket that slammed into the side of the train, just behind the gills, the flexible corridor between the engine and the first car. The front of the train leaned over precariously. It would have righted itself, but another Marine fired a second rocket into the side of the engine, tipping the heavy car over. The train had come close enough to the station that it had already begun to slow for its stop. With so little momentum, many of the rear cars did not follow the engine off the track, but sat upright just behind the cars that had tipped over. One of the cargo doors opened on the train. There was a moment of silent mystery. Then 3 tarred tanks rumbled out of that compartment. Targs were an old model of anti-personnel tanks. They had smaller cannons and carried light armor, but they could scoot at speeds up to 170 miles per hour. They were only 5 feet high. When they got going, their low-slung profile reminded me of spiders. These particular tanks would not need heavy armor, not with those MOGAT shields. In our rush to nail that first train, Phillips and I had separated ourselves from the platoon. It didn't seem important at the time, but seeing those Targs rush toward the station, I knew we were cut off.
Phillips, give me the launcher.
He handed me the rocket launcher, then took up his M27.
Master Sarge, I don't like the look of those tanks.
I fired a quick shot at one of the tanks. Flame and smoke filled the air, and the tank rolled through them untouched. The turret turned in our direction as the tank driver looked to return fire. Phillips and I lay flat on the ground, hiding behind a waist-high wall. Another cargo car opened, and 3 more tanks spilled out. Down the alley, I could see more tanks offloading.
We can't stop the tank! The other platoon is clearing out!
Go with them. You got that? Fall back. Get back to the apartment building.
Got it! What about you?
Fall back. You read me, Tomer? Fall back.
Yes, sir!
Safest place for us is in that there train.
Phillips pointed to the wreck he had made. I knew he was right.
Stay down.
I pulled a smoke grenade from my arm and tossed it into the open area between us and the train.
Let's go.
The upended engine lay on its side, its roof facing in my direction just a few feet ahead. I lunged forward and hid behind its mast.
That was close.
Gonna get a lot more exciting around here.
I found a handhold and scaled the roof of the engine. We needed to find a way inside. I climbed to the top of the train. Several cars ahead of us, a MOGAT popped out of a doorway. His head, chest, and rifle stuck out of the train. He went down, and I found an open doorway just behind the gills of the train and jumped in. What a mess we'd created. With the train on its side, rows of seats hung horizontally in the air like padded shelves. Some bodies lay slumped in the seats. Others were thrown across the car. The ceiling of the train car was to my left. All the light fixtures along the ceiling had shattered. I pivoted around and aimed my 27, then saw that it was Phillips.
Don't shoot, Harris! It's me!
I called to my squad leader.
What's going on out there?
It's getting ugly. They parked two trains out of range and offloaded tanks. There's a column headed right for us.
Targs?
Bigger. I think the Targs were meant to pin us down while they waited for the real guns to arrive.
Where are you?
We're still in the station. They sent Targs around the building to cut us off.
The door to the next compartment fell open, and a Mogat aimed his machine gun. I snatched a grenade, pulled the pin, and tossed it through the open doorway. I climbed over the remains of the door.
I'm not sure how long they'll hold up against those tanks.
Good news, gentlemen.
The colonel had to be calling about the shields. If they were down, we could shoot our way out of this killing bottle.
Navy SEALs have touched down on Mogat territory.
Speck? They've only specking touched down? That's great, sir. Why don't you call me when they shut down the specking power?
Watch yourself, Sergeant!
Sorry, sir.
You and I are gonna have a conversation when this war is over, Harris.
Harris, are you there?
Tomer called over the platoon band.
I'm here. What's going on out there?
They're closing in on us.
Did the other platoon make it out?
Some of them. Tanks caught a bunch of them in the open. Half of them did not make it across.
Squad count.
I'm down to 9.
7.
5.
Of my original 42 men, I now had 23 remaining, including myself. If I did not find some way to get my men out of there, the roll call might only find 2.
Hold on. I'll find a way to draw some of the heat off of you. Just hold on.
Everything hinged on the SEALs. Our invasion was meant to draw Mogat forces away. Well, we'd pulled that one off. If the SEALs could just accomplish their objectives, some of us might survive.
Harris, over here.
I came across the car. Along the left wall, which had become the floor when the whole train tipped on its side, lay stacks of clear canisters filled with some sort of swirling brown gas. The canisters were strapped down tight. Nothing short of a grenade would have shattered them. The Mogats did not take any chances with this cargo. Stacks of a different sort hung from the top of the train, canisters filled with gray glittering gas. Seeing these lethal weapons, I could not help but smile.
What is this shit?
The brown ones are distilled shit gas. This is the most corrosive stuff you'll ever see. Eats anything soft. Skin, wires, rubber.
I pointed to the canisters on the other wall. They were filled with compressed silver gas. They looked like they might have contained mercury.
You know what this is, right?
No.
That's noxium gas. You've heard of noxium gas before.
Oh, yes. I've heard of it.
Terrorists favored noxium because it was cheap and scary. It bored into people and turned them to jelly, then dispersed into the air. You could shoot it into a building, kill everyone inside, then enter the building yourself 5 minutes later. The air would be clean.
How are you holding up out there?
Rumsfeld. They've got specking Rumsfeld.
Of course there were Rumsfelds. I should have known there would be Rumsfelds. That explained the gas canisters. Rumsfelds were designed to spew supercharged gas. They also packed the standard machine guns and cannons. Despite all the weapons and armor, the Rumsfeld was obsolete before it rolled off the assembly line. It moved too slowly for practical use in battle. Other battlefield units could outmaneuver Rumsfelds and ultimately cut them down. The government had labeled them obsolete 30 years ago, but they should have been discontinued long before that.
Are they on you?
I worked as I spoke, hoping to find the guns that foot soldiers used to shoot gas canisters. I found a rack of compressed gas shooters near the door. These were breech-loading rifles with barrels as thick as baseball bats.
Bearing down. Just hold on. Help is on the way.
Rumsfeld's had a closed circulation system with filters that could weed out noxium gas, a biogas that quickly evaporated into the environment. I did not think the tank's filters would hold up against distilled shit gas, however. I pulled off my helmet and placed 4 canisters of shit gas into it. The canisters were about 3 inches tall and 2 inches in diameter. I removed 3 of the other canisters as well, the ones with the gray-colored gas. Phillips removed his helmet and did the same. Strapping a shooter to my back, I climbed to the top of the train. Up ahead, I saw at least 20 Targs facing into the station. Rumsfelds lurked in the distance. I sat on the edge of the doorway with my feet dangling down as I unstrapped that shooter.
Phillips, pass me my helmet.
Each of the tanks had brown camouflage paint and a golden crown painted on its turret. The Targs had formed an elliptical row about 40 feet from the station. Hoping to create an uncrossable puddle, I planned to fire distilled shit gas into the street behind the station. Distilled shit gas was heavy, and that puddle would last for hours. I would shoot canisters of Noxium gas in front of the station to clear a path. In the open air, the Noxium would do its work and evaporate in a minute. The canister sailed through the air so slowly that I could actually watch it as it hurtled toward the target. The shot lobbed over the roof of the train station. A moment later, the top of a silver-white cloud appeared in the air. I quickly loaded a canister of distilled shit gas. The canister flew into the center of the tanks, where it vanished in a rapidly spreading cloud of brown haze.
That gas won't hurt those tanks.
I loaded another canister of shit gas.
They have shields.
It won't hurt the outside of those tanks. Those boys have to breathe something. It's like spraying insects.
Phillips handed me the next canister. It was gray, Noxium gas. I loaded it into the shooter. I grabbed my helmet to scream into the microphone.
Get running!
Phillips handed me another canister of distilled shit gas. I raised my trajectory and fired at the Rumsfelds in the distance. Dinosaurs that they were, the first of the Rumsfelds charged straight ahead, directly into the spreading cloud. Phillips handed me another canister. I loaded it and fired deeper into their line. I did not want any stragglers to escape. One of the Rumsfelds fired back.
Incoming! Give me a brown one!
Targs were now coming in our direction. I reached down without saying a word and he slapped a canister into my hand. I loaded and fired at the tanks. And they fired at us.
Duck!
I dropped into the train. Phillips placed his helmet top down on the floor and laid over it, cradling it in his arms. If he'd seen what those gases could do to a man, he would not have been so brave. I emptied the remaining canisters out of my helmet, then pulled my helmet down over my head.
Report, what was that?
What is your status?
Safe for now. We made it to an apartment building. What did you hit them with?
Bug spray. Be ready to make a quick exit from your building. The reason they brought that shit out here was to feed it to you.
I headed back into the car with all of the gas canisters.
What are you doing? The Mogats know we're here.
I pulled a grenade from my armor. I programmed the grenade for maximum yield and set it to explode on impact. Then I pulled the pin and laid it to rest between two canisters of distilled shit gas. Then I set three more grenades the same way.
They know we're in the train and they're coming after us. They're probably going to shell the train to shake us loose, right?
Those canisters were designed to not explode until fired from a shooter, but I had the feeling that a grenade might do the trick. Looking around the car, I did not find what I wanted. I rushed to the next car and found it, a small airtight case for carrying canisters. I went back and fitted 8 canisters of Noxium gas and 4 canisters of distilled shit gas into the case. Satisfied that I had the right load, I headed for a doorway through which I could leave the train. I had the canister shooter strapped over my shoulder. I carried my M27 in my right hand and the case of gas canisters in my left. I also had 2 canisters of Noxium gas tucked into my armor. If anything broke those canisters...
Where are you going?
That way.
I pointed to my left. The Mogats were coming from the right.
I'm headed that way and going as fast as I can.
Why left?
Do you want to head right?
Guess not.
We climbed out of the train.
Those tanks back there are going to start shelling this train in another minute. That will set off my grenade.
Gas is going to leak out of every orifice.
Harris, you better beat it out of there. The whole freaking Mogat army is headed in your direction.
Evans, where are you? Give me a beacon on your building.
Just up the street. I can see you from the window.
The virtual beacon turned the building blue in my visor.
Are the streets clear?
Not entirely. I sent my snipers up to the roof to clear a way for you.
Call your boys in. We'll catch up with you. But for now, I want everyone tucked in safe.
Harris, those tanks are getting closer.
I got it. Just bring your squad in. Phillips, let's move out.
We ran one block, then another, before the shelling started. I ducked against the storefront. It was a 3-story laundromat, of all things, with an all-glass fascia, but it was the only choice we had. At least I knew it was empty.
Phillips, in here!
I pushed the door open and ran for the stairs. Phillips and I climbed to the top floor and hid behind a row of washers.
Oh, shit. Look at all those specking Mogats.
At that very moment, the tanks fired a barrage of shells. The Targs fired at the train. They pounded it. I could see the whole thing from the third floor of the laundromat. Shells and rockets slammed into that train. The gases did not mix. Brown and gray gases began oozing from the windows and doors of the train. The brown gas crept along the streets like a tide, swelling nearly 2 feet in the air. Targs might have been fast, but they were not built for sharp turns at top speeds. The first row of tanks on the scene cut sharp and managed to avoid the gas. The tanks that followed did not. Line after line of Targs stampeded into the deadly fog and stalled. From my third floor vantage point, I saw dozens of tanks stall in the distilled shit gas mist. I could also see hundreds beyond them that the gas would never reach. Around the train station, I saw the carcasses of the tanks that I'd gassed. They sat totally immobile, looking like stones. No, not stones. With their curved backs, squat, low-slung profiles, and their green camouflage, they looked like gargantuan frogs. At least, the targs looked like frogs. There were 20 Rumsfelds in the mix. From up here, they looked more like armadillos. The distilled shit gas I'd fired at the Rumsfelds would have dissolved the wiring in the tanks as well as the drivers. I shot the targs with noxium gas. They would still work, so long as you didn't mind sitting in the puddle of what once was an enemy soldier. A half mile away from the train station, the nearest traffic ramp spewed out a river of green personnel carriers. Our men had put up a fight there. Beside the ramp, a couple of trucks lay on their sides. But the men we sent to hold that ramp were dead or in retreat, and now tens of thousands of MOGATs poured out.
Talk to me, Evans. They stopped shooting. Can you see the street around your building?
I can't see the street from here.
No windows?
Got a window. I just can't see the street. There are too many specking MOGATs on it. Those speckers are everywhere.
How long can you hold out? I'm going to try to make it over to your building.
We barricaded the entrance. They might be able to bash through with their tanks, but I'd hate to be the first man to come through that door. We may go down, but we are not going down easy.
Is Phillips with you?
He's here, Tomer.
And he's okay?
Not a scratch on him.
Master Sergeant, there's no point in coming here. We're cooked.
Evans, we're all cooked. I don't know about Phillips, but I'd rather go down with my platoon. We'll find a way to reach you, Evans. Just hold on.
What about your friend, the giant with the rifle?
His name is Freeman. He came here hunting Crowley.
You mean Amos Crowley, the MOGAT general?
Crowley is a field general. He likes to go down to the field to fight with his men. He's down there somewhere right now. At least he should be. He'll be sleeping with Napoleon and Caesar if Freeman spots him.
Are the MOGATs outside your building, too?
I looked out the window. The path back to the train station was almost clear. Most of the tanks and troops had gathered around the tenements. The street around the building in which my platoon had hidden looked like a parking lot.
Nope. All's clear.
You should stay put.
Are you shitting me? Just keep some men by the back door. Phillips and I are on our way. Phillips?
Phillips stood in front of the window, staring down at the street. The sky had turned dark during the time that we hid in the laundromat. Bright lights shone all over the city, and fires blazed near the train station and some of the traffic ramps. Phillips removed his helmet as he viewed this panorama. He stood still as a tree, holding his M27 by the butt in his limp right hand, its muzzle pointing straight at the floor.
Look at all them speckin' MOGATs. Hell, with that many men, they don't need to shoot us. They can just wait till we run out of bullets, then trample us to death.
I pulled off my helmet and stood beside Phillips. Neither of us spoke for a time. Then I pointed to the building where the rest of the platoon was waiting.
They're only 6 blocks away.
Damn, Master Sarge. You can't possibly think we'll survive those 6 blocks.
You know what, Phillips? I really hate being called Master Sarge. The rank is Master Sergeant, not Master Sarge.
He smiled, but did not answer. Still glaring at Phillips, I replaced my helmet. It was at that moment that the lights went out. In the pitch darkness, my visor automatically switched to night for day vision. I stared out the big glass window down at a cityscape painted in blue, white, and black. I looked over at Phillips as he put on his helmet.
The power is out.
I can see that.
You don't get it.
I fired my M27 into the window.
Evans, Tomer, Greer, the shields are down.
Harris, you out there?
Nice to hear from you, Ilyich.
I'm the only SEAL with any time on this planet. They had to send me. I'm in their capital sector. You should have seen this place. It's wild. It's half government, half religious shrine. Too bad it's all going away.
By this time, Phillips and I had already started down the stairs.
You guys pulled a coup turning out the lights.
Not just the lights. We sent two teams into the military sector. Alpha Team took out their broadcast engine. Tango just knocked out their shield generator. Considering all the trouble these guys have caused, we wanted to shut them down for good.
Phillips and I ran into the street. Seen through the night for day lenses, the scene had no more depth than an old black and white photograph. I saw it in ghostly blue white. I could see details clearly enough. I could see clearly enough to know that I was staring into an empty street. I looked both ways, then switched to heat vision to make sure that no one was hiding. The walls gave off no heat, but tanks, men, and weapons all had heat signatures. The block ahead of us was clean.
When are you pulling out?
We're not. We're going to hang around until the green machine arrives.
The Green Machine was a corps name for the army.
Harris, what are you talking about?
The second wave. They're sending the army in to occupy...
Harris, the army isn't coming.
The Confederate Arms Navy is engaging the MOGAT fleet right now. Once we chew through their fleet, the MOGATs will be landlocked. All we need to do is pin them down on this rock for another 2 hours and...
No army?
Why would they send in the army? Now that the power is out, everything down here is going to revert back to elemental gas.
Distilled shit gas.
They'll all be dead.
We'll all be dead.
I felt stunned. I felt like I had received a knee in the groin. This was pain and confusion that even the combat reflex could not mask. I thought of Samson, blinded and captured by the Philistines. In a final show of faith, he killed himself and the Philistines by toppling their temple down upon his head.
Harris, you have to get out of there.
And go where? Where the speck are we supposed to go?
Even if we made it topside and boarded the transport, who would pick us up? If it were not for my programming, I would have shoved the muzzle of my M27 in my mouth and pulled the trigger. I felt numb. I felt dizzy. The Unified Authority had betrayed us. I should have known they would.
The battleships are still up there. If you make it up there before they leave, they'll take you.
No, they won't. They came to kill MOGATs, not rescue Marines.
Harris, you need to hurry. Without the shields, those MOGAT ships won't last long against the fleet.
How long do we have?
Till the Navy leaves or the whole city reverts back into elemental gas. You have 2 hours until everything down here melts. The Navy will be long gone by then.
Harris, could you get to a transport?
I had forgotten about Freeman.
Freeman?
Are you pinned down?
I gotta go. Simplify my ass.
I was a faithful servant to an unfaithful master. I was a fool. If I made it off this planet, I would turn my back on the Unified Authority once and for all. My programming might prevent me from fighting against bastards like Brocious, but I did not have to die as one of their pawns.
Get moving.
Freeman said nothing. He had offered to help. Now he was already on his way to the transport. I changed frequencies to call to the colonel commanding the operation.
What is it, Harris?
Call the men back to the transport, sir.
What are you talking about? Hold your position!
We've accomplished our mission.
We're supposed to hold our position until reinforcements arrive.
There won't be any reinforcements. The army's not coming.
You're full of... Harris, give me a minute.
We don't have a minute.
I switched frequencies so that my entire platoon could hear me.
Boys, we're in trouble. We need to make a run for the transport. When I give you the signal, fire everything you have at the MOGATs in front of your building. Then when I clear you, run out the back door and keep running. Do you read me, Marines? What about the ones in the back? I've got them, Evans. You just start shooting when you get my signal.
Where are you?
I'm 2 blocks out the ass of your building. You hit them from your side and I'll hit them from back here.
There are too many.
We don't need to kill them. They're already blind. Just run on my command and keep running until you are topside and harnessed into your transport. You got that, spec sucker? That is an order.
Yes, sir.
Peering out from behind a wall, I saw that the street was filled with enemy soldiers and tanks. They had the enemy trapped, but no one had given them their next orders. Without their power grid, they could not communicate with their commanders. Phillips and I crouched behind a wall and watched the MOGATs for a moment.
Hold this.
I handed the case with the gas cartridges to Phillips. Phillips took the case without saying a word. I leaned my M27 against the wall, then pulled the canister shooter off my shoulder. I broke it open at the hinge and loaded a canister of noxium gas in its chamber. Once I fired the shooter, it would take 3 minutes for the gas to dissipate. I aimed the shooter so that it would spit the canister deep into the MOGAT's rank. I loaded my second cartridge. This time I aimed at the MOGATs in the rear. Someone else might have described the scene as pandemonium, but to me it spoke of entropy. The MOGAT troops fell into disarray from which they would never again organize. They ran, they panicked, they dissolved into the street. On the other side of the building, the other MOGATs must have heard the noise. They must have wondered what had happened. I waited a few more moments before radioing up to Evans. I wanted to make sure the noxium gas evaporated before he came running out.
Light them up!
Evans and his squad began firing their rockets at the tanks. Exploding rockets and firing cannons made different sounds. To the untrained, it all sounds like a big bang. Once you've been in combat, you learn to listen for pitch, intensity, duration, and volume. I heard the sounds of the tanks returning fire.
Evacuate the building! Now!
They got Evans!
Out of there, Tomer! Move it!
Are the MOGATs out the back?
The street is clear!
The colonel's voice sounded over the interlink.
Everyone fall back to the transport! Anyone who does not make it back to the transport in 15 minutes will be left behind!
The back door of the apartment building flew open and out ran my platoon, or what remained of it, a 20-man stampede. They ran straight ahead, straight into the clutter of bodies that filled the street. By this time, the noxium had largely accomplished its purpose. Phillips and I saw the scene from 2 blocks up the street. Our boys dashed out of the building. Moments later, another platoon followed. They could follow us if they liked, but I would not waste time waiting for them. I jumped into the street, making a pinwheel motion with my arm to direct my men on.
Phillips, take the lead.
Phillips knew the way to the elevator station. I had shown it to him in the laundromat.
You heard him. This way. Now move!
I had just joined Tomer at the back of the pack when the first of the Targ rounded a corner ahead of us. Its spotlight cut through the darkness. Its beam looked as hard and pale as a marble pillar. The light never found us. And inside the tank, the driver only saw what his spotlight showed him. A moment later, one of our grenadiers fired a rocket at the Targ. By this time, we had almost reached the elevator station. The road we were on came to a dead end at the door of the station, which towered above everything around it. The elevator station reached all the way to the ceiling, 100 feet above us. With the power down, I could now see a rough rock ceiling instead of a sky overhead. Three Rumsfelds rolled out onto the street 1,000 feet behind us. Their searchlights sniffed along the ground until they located Marines from the other platoon.
Light 'em!
I ran in the door of the elevator station and turned to see the street. I saw searchlights, tanks, and Marines in retreat.
Phillips, Tomer, get them topside.
There were no stairs in the elevator station. With the power down, the elevators would no longer work. Since we did not come with jetpacks, the only way up was using ropes. Fortunately, the magnetic link between our armor and the rappel cords would make the climb easier. Any man who could not climb those 100 feet would stay behind and die. With the power out, I did not know if the gravity chute would work. All I could do was hope that it ran on a natural convection created by the distilled chit gas. On the other hand, I did not want to know what the gas might do to a transport. A searchlight shone across the entrance of the elevator station. It was from a Rumsfeld at least 100 yards away. The light formed a blinding circle that scoured the road outside the station, then shone on the door. I stepped back and hid behind a wall as the light played past me. I looked back at the men. A few had started to climb. Most stood in front of the shaft, waiting their turn.
Any of you have rockets?
One of the men came over and handed me a launcher and 3 rockets. They were small, no bigger than my fist.
Thanks. Now get topside.
Outside, the Rumsfeld moved toward the door of the station. I looked back again. All but 3 of my men had started up the shaft. Phillips, Greer, and Tomer were still down, but I knew they could handle the climb. Seeing Phillips grab a cord, I had to smile. We were going to make it out of this shithole. More than half of my platoon would survive this mission. I started to head toward the cords. But just as I did, I caught a glimpse of something that made me freeze. At first, I thought the Mogats had turned the power back on. In the distance, the civilian sector glowed brightly. The light that filled the sky was so bright that the lens in my visor switched from night for day to standard tactical. Tint shields clouded my visor when I looked directly into the glare. The light did not come from the city. It came from behind it. It wasn't just light. It wasn't like the glow of a searchlight or even 1,000 searchlights. The light above the city constantly changed hues and patterns as if the reds, yellows, and blues separated and remixed with each other. Patterns of color rose like smoke out of the glow. It looked something like the Aurora Borealis, only enormous sparks flashed in it. For a moment, I thought the light might be coming from the city itself. Maybe light happened when buildings made of distilled chit gas decomposed, but I did not have time to waste reasoning it out.
Harris, you seeing this?
Where are you, Freeman?
What floor up? You better get climbing.
You can see that light?
I took one last glance out the door. The light had a slow gelatinous property about it. It seemed to seep over the city like viscous oil. As soon as I turned from the door, the night for day lens resumed in my visor. The glow from that strange light had not yet reached the elevator station, but it would soon. I ran to the elevator shaft, grabbed a cord, and started up.
Tomer, where are you?
In the elevator station.
Can you see any transport?
There's a transport just outside.
I requisitioned us that one.
What happened to the pilot?
Freeman did not answer. The area inside the shaft would have been black as coal if not for the glow that started to pour into it. It gushed in like a flood of water, shining on the opposite wall.
Yeah. Load the men into transport.
They're in.
And you're in?
Tomer did not answer.
Get in the transport!
I looked up to see how much farther I had to go, but I did not pause. I had another 20 feet. Below me, the light in the shaft became blinding. It was like looking into the sun. The tint shields in my visor blocked out some of the brightness, but when I tried to look up again, I found that my eyes would not adjust to the darkness. I looked back down. That was when I saw it. There was a creature in that viscous light. Whatever it was, the creature I saw was nearly as bright as the light around it. It looked like a 6-foot canary yellow smudge in a field of glare that had the startling silver-white clarity of an electrical spark. I only saw it for a moment, and I mostly concentrated on the two silver-black eyes. They were too large for that head, the size of my fists, and they seemed to be made of smoky black chrome. For a brief moment, my eyes met that creature's eyes, and I saw no pity in him. Then I saw that the creature held a rifle of some kind.
Oh, shit!
I managed to climb even faster. The bolt might have been some sort of white laser, if there can be such a thing. It might or might not have been any more powerful than our particle beams. But the bolt cut through the cords around me and struck a wall. The spot it struck glowed white and orange, and distilled shit gas gushed out of it like blood from a bullet hole. The men above me must have seen the shot too. One of them leaned into the shaft and lowered an M27.
I can't hit it.
Two sets of arms grabbed me and pulled me out of the shaft. Phillips and Tomer pulled me to my feet as Freeman dropped a grenade down the shaft. We sprinted out of the elevator station. Outside the station, the strange, gelatinous light continued to creep toward us. It was less than a mile away, moving at a slow pace. Running as fast as I could to the transport, I did not have time to stop and check. We rushed the ramp. Freeman climbed the ladder and entered the cockpit with all the dexterity of a spider checking its web. We were already off the ground when the doors at the rear of the kettle banged shut. I looked around the kettle and tore off my helmet.
Get harnessed!
I crossed the deck and climbed up to the cockpit. Freeman sat at the controls, holding the yoke with one hand and hitting switches with the other. Through the windshield, I could see the landscape ahead of us. The tide of light continued to move toward us. I did not see tanks or gunships or armies moving inside it. Then Freeman rotated the ship toward the gravity chute. Staring out of the cockpit, I saw Marines running out of elevator stations and transports taking off. We might not be the only ones who made it out, if we made it out. There was still the question about the gravity chute. Freeman slowed down as he approached the chute the way the MOGAT pilots did.
Do you know how it works?
You just fly into it. It's like an elevator.
We approached the chute so slowly that we seemed to inch toward it. I felt like we would simply drop. And then the updraft caught us and we rose. I peered over the nose of the transport. I saw another transport below us. And then I saw the strange light spreading over everything below.
Did you see that thing that shot at me in the elevator shaft?
Freeman shook his head.
It wasn't human.
I could not shake the image of those metallic eyes watching me as I climbed up the dark elevator shaft. For the first time since I entered the Marines, I had felt real fear, mortal fear. Fear undiluted by the delirious effects of the combat reflex. Even the hormone in my blood had not kept me calm. And now, standing behind Freeman, I realized that I was still trembling. We rose more quickly up the gravity chute than I had expected. Whatever was happening in the MOGAT city below had accelerated the natural convection. It was probably consuming thousands of Marines and millions of MOGATs as well. Glare, as bright as sunlight, shone up the shadowy length of the chute. Rainbow colors spiraled on the rock just below us. At some point, the light faded, and a minute later we emerged on the dark surface of the planet. There was no hint of whatever was happening below. Freeman flew us out of that hollowed-out mountain and straight up out of the atmosphere. A few moments later, we received the message I think we both doubted would come.
UA Transport, this is the battleship Sakura. Please prepare to dock.
Wild Bill Grace, the senior member of the Linear Committee, stood at the podium smiling at his audience. Gordon Hughes, the chairman of the Confederate Arms, stood behind him. Both men smiled so freely you would never guess that they had recently sent navies to annihilate each other. Behind them, two flags hung from crossed staffs, the Unified Authority, Stars and Bars, and the Confederate Arms, Map of the Galaxy. Seated at the back of the podium were Admiral Brawlier, General Smith, and several other officers I recognized. An empty seat marked Admiral Brocious's place. He was in exile back on the Central Cygnus fleet. He had sent Freeman to die along with me and my platoon. He had deceived Ray Freeman just as he had the rest of us. But there was no programming in Freeman's natural-born brain to cause him to overlook the indiscretion. Freeman would take his revenge. Once he learned that we had survived, Brocious fled to the safety of his ships. Admiral Brawyer looked particularly pleased with himself, sitting beside Brocious's empty seat. Brocious's obsession with house odds had done him in. He tried to hedge his bets against the Mogats by sacrificing the Marines. He improved the odds against Freeman by sending him to die on a wild goose chase. Crowley was never on the Mogat planet. He had died fighting his former allies when the Mogats attacked the Confederate arms as they battled for control of the fleet. Yoshi Yamashiro gave us that scrap of information on our way back to Earth. Wild Bill held a single sheet of paper.
Perhaps we can get started. I'd like to start by introducing my colleague for this occasion, Mr. Gordon Hughes, chairman of the Confederate Arms. This afternoon, at 2:30 Washington, D.C. time, the Unified Authority and Confederate Arms launched an invasion into Mogat space. We sent an invasion force of 60,000 Unified Authority Marines and 200 Navy SEALs to the home world of the Morgan-Atkins movement. At the same time, the Confederate Arms sent its 40-ship self-broadcasting fleet to support the invasion. I am pleased to announce that the invasion was an unqualified success. The Mogat threat has been eliminated. We have destroyed their base of operations, and we have destroyed their self-broadcasting fleet. I think it is safe to say that we have closed the door once and for all on the Morgan-Atkins uprising. Are there any questions?
Grace selected a pretty female reporter and pointed to her.
When did you create an alliance with the Confederate Arms? And does this mean the Confederate Arms will be rejoining the Republic?
Gordon Hughes stepped up to join Wild Bill.
Perhaps I could answer that. Ambassadors from the Unified Authority approached us several months ago. As you may know, our alliance with the Mogats ended quickly.
This might have been the 100th time I replayed the briefing. It was a work of art that mystified me. Grace and Hughes put on a splendid show. They never hinted that the invasion had ended in the total annihilation of an entire planet. They never mentioned the Japanese fleet. They sure as hell never mentioned that they'd left tens of thousands of Marines stranded or that they annihilated 200 million civilians. To listen to those two prophets, you would have thought that we won a conventional battle on Mogatopolis and that the long-dead Morgan Atkins handed over his sword from his grave.
You're not watching that briefing again.
Freeman stepped into the courtyard. I removed my shades. I was sitting on a deck chair in an open-air courtyard in a villa on the Hawaiian island of Oahu. I'd stayed here 4 years earlier, shortly after I was promoted to sergeant. When I received my honorable discharge 3 months ago, I marched off the base and boarded a plane to Hawaii. I rented the villa and had been staying here ever since.
You think I spend too much time watching the briefing?
I picked up the space Bible I'd placed beside my chair. The book was 600 pages long. I'd read it 5 times now.
You spend too much time with the book, too. Now, if you wanted to become a Mogat, you shouldn't have done it before you helped kill everyone on that planet.
His joke struck a nerve. I had helped kill 200 million people. 200 million. I didn't feel bad about the soldiers, but the faces of the civilians still haunted me day and night. I was obsessed with that briefing, and everything Grace and Hughes did not divulge. I was obsessed with the Space Bible and everything Morgan Atkins had told the world. When the book first appeared, people dismissed it as a hoax. As far as the public knew back then, Atkins had died during the Liberator invasion, and that was all they knew. When evidence emerged that Atkins had not died and that the book was authentic, everyone dismissed his book as the work of a crackpot. Now that I had read the book, I did not blame them. In it, Atkins talked about uncovering an alien city buried in the core of a planet in the center of the galaxy. He referred to the radiant being who guarded the city as a space angel. The Angel, he said, warned him that his race would soon invade our galaxy. Atkins said he created an alliance with the creature. He would unite the galaxy under his control, and the Radiant aliens would leave mankind alone. That was why he needed to subvert the government, so that he could set up a government of his own. He wanted to save us. Morgan Atkins was actually the good guy. No wonder no one believed it. It sounded ridiculous. From what I had seen, Atkins told the truth about some things, but I had trouble envisioning that space angel as a benevolent partner. I did not think the Unified Authority would be able to stand up to those aliens. I abandoned the Christian Bible and began studying the Space Bible because Morgan Atkins had a more powerful God.
You think I should stop reading? I'll stop reading.
I tossed the Space Bible back on the table.
You can't stay here forever. Now, you're not going to be able to sit this one out. If we cannot stop them, they're going to kill everybody. You might as well commit suicide to sit this one out.
Stop them? Are you joking? We barely beat the specking Mogats. These guys will eat us alive.
Part of me actually believed that Freeman was talking to me. Sometimes it was Freeman who came to talk me into rejoining the war. Sometimes it was Phillips. And sometimes it was Tomer. But it was all in my imagination. Phillips and Tomer and the rest of my platoon remained in Washington, D.C. Given the option to retire, they'd all re-enlisted. Some young lieutenant now commanded my platoon. Yoshi Yamashiro and the Japanese returned to Earth. The Unified Authority allowed them to settle on the original islands of Japan. His four battleships now orbited the Earth. I did not know where Ray Freeman was. He simply vanished while we orbited Earth. He said he would join this fight, but he had no intention of fighting it as a Marine or a soldier. Not Freeman. He was a mercenary. But I had no intention of fighting or of rejoining the Marines. The UA had betrayed me too many times. Yes, I would die too, but at least I would not die protecting a government that had tricked me and left me to die. One thing seemed certain. We were all going to die. Yet, deep inside, I knew I was just fooling myself. Sooner or later, I would get sucked in again. After all, I was a military clone. Like it or not, I was government property. And the final battle was coming. Rogue Clone, The Clone Alliance, is a graphic audio production. Published by arrangement with Richard Curtis Associates, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Copyright 2008, Stephen L. Kent. Production copyright 2012, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Ken Jackson, Joe Brack, Terrence Aislefford, James Lewis, Christopher Sheeran, Evan Casey, Elliot Dash, David Coyne, James Konacek, Tony Nam, Richard Rowan, Bradley Smith, Danny Gavigan, Mort Shelby, Thomas Keegan, Nanette Savard, Johan Detweiler, Dexter Hamlet, and Dylan Lynch. Directed by Ken Jackson. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johan Detweiler. The Rogue Clone theme was composed by Temeskin Wubna. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johan Detweiler. If you enjoyed Rogue Clone, be sure to look for the Vampire Earth series and Elizabeth Moon's Vata's War, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Don't think I give a damn that you're my father.
The thought never crossed my mind.
I don't know you, and I don't want to know you. All you ever gave me was a rep to live up to. I done it too. Maybe I haven't killed as many men as the famous Frank Morgan, but my day's coming, old man. My day's coming.
Can Frank Morgan gun down his own flesh and blood? Find out in The Last Gunfighter number 23, Montana Gundown. Available now in graphic audio. The Samhasts have been driven to the brink of extinction. But from the depths of a primeval source of power, a new threat is rising. The last stand of the Samhasts will bring the land of Haunts to the brink of destruction. And this time, even the Highwayman may not be able to save the world from the darkness of the Ancient. Don't miss the thrilling continuation of the Saga of the First King in R.A. Salvatore's The Ancient. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.